Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, starting the show today by talking about sports injuries and rehabilitation. Chris Geiser with us. He's a clinical associate professor and program director of athletic training at Marquette University. And we'll be talking with Chris about how athletes get back in the game after an injury, and certainly take calls from you as well. Have you ever been injured while playing sports? Maybe you're in physical therapy or work in that area. What do you see in terms of athletic injuries? Whatever, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Chris Geiser, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry, for having me. This is my first time on live radio, so I'm a little nervous here, but it sounds like you guys got things well under control.
Oh, we got it well under control, and you sound great. Let's just start with common injuries. What are some of the most common sports injuries that are out there?
And that's, again, we teach our students, you know, the most common thing we see are ankle sprains, obviously, in any sport, but often that depends on the setting and the level that you're dealing with at that point. So it's probably a different most common injury if you're talking about the Packers versus talking about your youth football on the sidelines that way. But they are pervasive in sports, and injuries are going to happen. They're part of sports, and so, you know, being prepared and dealing with them appropriately is probably the first step in participating in sports.
Yeah, my daughter played soccer in high school cross country, and now she runs cross country and track in college. So there were some injury, and ankle sprains were one of the injuries that she often had. Typically, how long does it take to recover from something like that?
Oh, that's all over the gamut, Larry. And really, we junk basket term an ankle sprain, but that can encompass a lot of different injuries, right? Anywhere from one ligament to three ligaments to different ligaments. But you know, we look at that as a common injury. And you mentioned women's soccer is probably one of the highest injury rates of all the sports that are played out there. You know, when we think of injuries, we think of football or we think of, you know, high collision sports, but women's soccer is right up there with at the top of the list for the rate of injuries and the severity of the injuries that we encounter.
Yeah, as we look at the difference between men, girls, and boys, or men and women, is there much of a difference between men and women in terms of the injuries, the type of injury?
Yeah, we see slightly higher injury rates and different types of injuries in the two types of sports. So, or in the two sexes in the sports they play. And so we take that into appreciation and in the rehab process and in covering those events and taking care of those injuries. We try to prepare appropriately for what we're going to see and the incidents that we're going to run into.
And men, correct me if I'm wrong, men seem to get injured more than women. Is that right? I think that was according to some injuries stats from the CDC, but I just wonder why the heck is that?
Yeah, if that's the case, again, I haven't seen that in my experience, and in the literature I've seen, women have a slightly higher injury rate when playing the same sport. Now, overall, men may get more injured because there's more guys playing football, I bet.
So
that may impact the overall number of injuries that are out there, and there may be a higher participation rate by guys in athletics still in this day and age. But I think when you compare apples to apples, the injury rate is pretty similar, and women may actually get injured a little bit more frequently.
There was a study by the Journal of Athletic Training and reporting that women have a higher rate of overuse injuries. Maybe you could describe that injury.
Yeah. So the two types of injuries that we kind of break things into, or the two categories, are traumatic injuries. And those are the ones you're used to seeing, where somebody gets crushed on the field or somebody runs into something or falls on something. And then there are overuse injuries. And overuse injuries are a result of, you know, some overload or some tissue that isn't able to keep up to the sustained loads that are placed on it. So kneecap tracking issues or tendonitises tend to be more overuse injuries. They're tissues that are getting stressed in a way that is not allowing adequate recovery for those tissues to keep up on the remodeling process and to handle getting themselves better and staying in a normal state or able to handle the stresses that are on it. So a stress fracture is a type of overuse injury. So if we know in cross country, and you said your daughter does cross country, but yeah. if runners run too many miles and don't allow enough recovery time for their bony structure to remodel itself into a stronger fashion, eventually the breakdown of the training will result in a discernible line or discernible pain that is what we call a stress fracture.
So I guess on an overuse injury, the what makes sense to me is that the reason it happens or recurs is because people don't wait long enough or don't rest long enough before getting back into it.
That's certainly part of it. So if you're experiencing an injury of that sort, the first thing we do when we evaluate it is we make sure that we understand what's going on and we have a proper diagnosis. But then secondly is figuring out why it occurred in the first place. And we can have a situation, like I mentioned, where somebody did not allow enough recovery. We call that a training error. Or we can have a situation where there might be some issue in the tissue itself that's not able to handle normal loads. You may do the same training as everybody else on your team, but because of the way your legs are shaped or way your tissues handle stress, you may not be able to handle the same load that they do. And so then we might look at whether there's ways to correct your leg position or biomechanics or the strength or the flexibility or something within you that overloads that particular area. And so that's part of the rehab process and part of why athletic trainers and physical therapists don't make the big bucks we get paid to figure all this stuff out in some way, shape, or form.
All right. Chris Geiser, our guest, clinical associate professor and program director of athletic training at Marquette University, talking with him today about athletic injuries. Seems like a good time to be talking about. We're heavy into the sports season. We got the Super Bowl coming up. We've got even sooner than that, we've got the Olympics. I believe the Winter Olympics are, when do they start? Is it this weekend?
I think it's the next couple of days. I think they're coming up that way. But
yeah,
you guys had in your news right before this that Tom Brady is announcing retirement and going that way. And there's an example of somebody who really went to the extremes to take care of himself and to make sure that he stayed on the right side of those overuse injuries, and that he kept himself healthy, he kept himself well nutritionally, and from all reports, again, I don't know him from the next guy, but somebody who really seemed to take seriously the preventative side of injury prevention.
Yeah, and he, I think, probably also knew how. I mean, he threw a lot of short passes. He got the ball away in a hurry, and he also knew how to take a hit pretty well. Which
when not to take a hit.
And when not to take a hit. Join in with your own questions or comments. By the way, the number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Concussions. I was thinking about when you mentioned soccer. I know there were kids, there was a kid on another team from my daughter's team that suffered her third concussion in soccer, and that was it. I mean, she couldn't play anymore.
Yeah, at some point your executive function, your brain power, and your personality become more important than the game that you're trying to get involved with that way. So the concussions, recognizing their severity, has certainly taken the forefront in the last number of years here, and we've really made some strides in understanding a bit of how concussions should be managed and how we handle them and a bit on how we prevent these to keep people back in the game. But I'm really truly appreciating the potential for problems down the road and the seriousness of an injury to your brain, I think is probably one of the big strides we've made in the last couple of years.
Yeah, for sure. And, you look at there was some figures on the NFL and concussions. I think during the last five seasons, the average number of concussions reported was 247 over 5 years. And in 2020, I think there were 172 concussions reported. That was from the NFL Players Association. So, you know, what really happens to the brain when in a concussion?
Yeah, you think of when you know, jam your toe into the chair, you have a contusion of that toe if you don't fracture it, right? The brain acts the same way. You can bruise the brain and it bounces around in your head. So the brain is kind of free floating in the cerebral spinal fluid. And when you have a sudden deceleration of your head, like when your head hits another head or when your head hits the ball, the head decelerates and the brain moves forward and there's no airbags in your head other than the cerebral spinal fluid. And so you contuse those parts of your brain and cause an acute disruption in its function, but also you can have, you know, the effects of the bruising or the bleeding itself on the brain that way. So it's hard. I mean, we can grab a knee and we can move it in different directions and test what's wrong when you injure your knee. And with the brain, it does a lot of things. And so ferreting out the exact symptoms and problems that you're having become a little bit more tricky. We have a number of sideline assessments that we use standardly to decide whether we think we're dealing with a concussion or whether this person, you know, hit their head and has a bruise on their skull and it's not a concussion. But then, once they have a concussion, then we're starting to identify patterns in recovery and to manage that part of it much closer to prevent recurrence and prevent the very situation that you talked about with someone who is having long-term problems.
Yeah. What does a treatment program typically look like for that?
Yeah. So it's evolved a lot in the last couple of years. We went from, you know, the 70s and 80s era where you shook it off and you got back into the game, right?
Yeah.
And you know, the Brett Favre era where he didn't remember being back on the field and throwing a touchdown and later in his career you started to see maybe some of those effects. But now we went really conservative for a while where we figured that, you know, the brain just had to be allowed to heal and we shouldn't disrupt it and we should put people in dark rooms and you know, block off their visual stimuli, so we let the brain do what it does. And now it's a swinging pendulum a bit. Now the pendulum has come back a little more towards the middle, where we realize that if we take a normal athlete who has no injury and we put him in a dark room and didn't let him do anything, he would get depressed and he would get, you know, lethargic and sleepy and all these things that we see after concussion. So we kind of hit this middle of the road a little bit, where we try to allow people to be involved in what they can without increasing their symptoms or without exacerbating their symptoms. So if you're having headaches and dizziness, we need to rest you, sit you down a little bit. But if you just have a headache and you can still read and that doesn't make your headache worse and doesn't make your dizziness worse, we let you start getting back into some of that stuff a little bit sooner. But we're always letting symptoms guide that a little bit to some degree.
Yeah.
And then really protecting the return to make sure you're truly back to where you should be before you're even stepping back into the exercise realm.
Our guest, Chris Geiser from Marquette University. He's the program director of athletic training at Marquette. Courtney Everett is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at athletic injuries, are you an athlete that's dealt with an injury? What happened? You work in physical therapy. What do you see in terms of athletic injuries? With our guest today, doing great here, Chris Geiser, clinical associate professor and program director of athletic training at Marquette University, one of our great universities here in the state. So it's great to have him with us. You can join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Bill in Oregon, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a bit past my prime in the athletic world, but did a lot of wrestling and football many years ago. And ever since, I've been dealing with a lot of spinal compression issues, mm-hmm. and I do neck exercises and flexibility exercises and a lot of things, and wanted to ask about the efficacy of inversion tables.
Ah.
For this kind of, for the, specifically for, you know, for spinal compression issues, there's, because I have nerve issues and there's a whole bunch of things just from my, from all the different pieces all fitting together, not quite as well as I used to. And just kind of what, because just kind of curious whether inversion seems to, whether there is any efficacy to that and what other options are available besides what I'm already doing, which is flexibility, stretching, strengthening.
Okay, thanks, Bill, for calling. Is this an issue that you deal with from time to time, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. In the realm of things that we handle fairly frequently. Now, as Bill asked about inversion tables specifically with respect to the treatment of his spine. And
what are they, by the way?
So an inversion table is something where you, if you think about how a bat hangs upside down, an inversion table fixes your feet in an apparatus, and then it has a hinge where it can invert you into an upside down position. And so it uses the weight of your body and gravity to kind of pull or decompress or pull the different segments of your spine apart that way. And so, Bill, to get at your question a couple of ways, the first thing I can say is that the good news is that I don't think there's any harm in doing an inversion table as long as it's not painful and as long as you don't have risks for cardiovascular problems in your head or something where your blood pressure is going to get out of whack by inverting you that way. And so as long as there's no reason not to do an inversion table, it doesn't seem to hurt spines that way. The evidence in the literature would say that there's not a ton of benefit across the board in controlled studies for that type of thing. In certain people, they do report an improvement in their symptoms, even if it's a bit temporary for a bit. But if it helps you feel better for a short period of time and it keeps you from popping an aspirin or a Tylenol or something that way, that's probably a positive outcome for you. So again, it's as long as you don't have vascular issues in your head, it's worth trying. And if it seems to help, then by all means, go ahead and give it a try. It's certainly better than maybe a medicating route towards managing your pain.
Yeah, there you go, Bill. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Beth in Oconomowoc. Hi, Beth.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was cycling last May and took a fall, fractured my hip, had a hip pinning done. And the recovery through lots of physical therapy and just seemed to be taking a long time. And after about 8 months, I went in to see a sports medicine physician. And what they discovered was that I had a full thickness tear in my gluteus medius tendon. So went in for surgery. They removed the hardware, repaired the tendon, and also found a bone fragment that they reattached. And so now I'm about almost 4 weeks into my recovery from surgery, minimal weight bearing, no abduction. I'm just wondering what kind of rehab I can do once the 6 weeks of recovery is done so that I can get back to skiing and cycling and just being as active as I want to be.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's an interesting situation you talk about, and that's certainly a long road of, towards recovery. I'm sure it's frustrating for you at certain times. The first thing we think about in rehab is that we don't want to stress the healing tissue in a way that's going to damage it, right? So if you had gluteus medius repaired, gluteus medius functions and fires every time you take a step on that leg. So you didn't say if it's your right or your left, but if it's your right one and you stand on the right leg, that gluteus medius is supporting the entire weight of your body from caving over to the left side. So even walking is a really tough activity for gluteus medius and a good exercise for it. So how do we rehab it? We would start probably very easily by having you just put the foot down between the crutches or whatever assistive device you're using and just put a little bit of weight on it so we start to acclimate it again to that type of activity. Once we're sure that enough time has passed for healing and your doc is on board and all that type of stuff. So again, our rehab process starts with finding some minimal level of activity or effort that tissue can tolerate and can handle. And then we'll take it step by step and increment the forces up on that level until, you know, we define where it is you need to get to. So if you're talking about skiing and running and that type of stuff, those are all very gluteus medius intensive activities. They're also very hip intensive activities. And so You've probably, you know, not to be discouraging, but you've probably got some work ahead of you to get there. But if you keep the end range in mind and the end result in mind, and take each of these little steps seriously, where you move from the easier to the harder, and follow the guidance of the rehab professionals who are guiding that process. They're paid to know specifically in your situation, you know, how those forces are being managed, and to help you monitor how you're responding to those activities. So I hope that helps in some small way and guide your process.
Yeah, Beth, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. If I'm not mistaken, Chris, you specialize in sports biomechanics.
Yeah, so I did
explain that.
Some of my graduate work in biomechanics and sports, and so the field of biomechanics is huge. I mean, there it essentially means how the body responds to mechanical stresses. And so, if you can imagine, people who design cars are interested what happens to the body when you crash and in their car design. So there are biomechanists that work in that realm. I'm interested in the area of sports, where how, when we land on the ground and how we move, how do our biological tissues respond to that, and how do we control that as a system to help mitigate the risk of injury and deal with the forces that are placed on our body during athletics. So we use all kinds of fancy, fun tools for defining and measuring the forces that are put on the body, and we make inferences about what happens inside the body and try to add some math and some calculations to those forces to quantify the differences between forces in people and tissues.
So do you use it a lot in your day-to-day dealings with your athletes?
I use it a lot in my thinking. I mean, you know, if I see somebody who, like we talked about the overuse injuries early on, if I see somebody who has a problem at their knee, I'm thinking about the loads and the forces that are placed on their tissues around that knee and how that plays into the loads and how they're handling that part of it. And then, is there a way that we can train other muscles to take some of that load, or do they truly just need to back off and take the overall load down? So I'm not always measuring exactly what those loads are or calculating them out what they are, but the thought process is there in my head and very much in how we treat people. And that's part of what our students go through in learning is understanding how in the rehab process to appreciate tissue loads and how to sequentially increase those in a way that the body will handle.
Yeah. So it's science based for sure, but it's a little bit of art connected with it too.
And a very little bit of psychology dealing with people and helping them manage the situation they're in. We learn a lot about a little bit about a lot of different things in my field.
Mary in Fond du Lac, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering, getting back to this aversion therapy, if one has had joint replacements like in the hip or the knee, is that something that would really damage them if they did inversion therapy?
Yeah, I mean, I think the possibility is there. I would certainly check with the physician who did the joint replacement and get clearance before I'd try something like that. But after a joint replacement, oftentimes you get lots of scarring around that area, and the joint itself ends up a little tighter than it was before. And so it's not a contraindication to trying it. It doesn't mean you can't under any circumstance, but I would certainly get the opinion of somebody who's been in there and seen the inside of your hip or your knee before you try that.
There you go, Mary. Thank you. Again, you can call in 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Dennis from Madison emailed and wanted to know, when it comes to a severe ankle injury like you might have playing basketball or whatever, what are the pros and cons of an ankle fusion and ankle transplant? Is there such a thing?
So I think he's probably talking, it's not transplant, it would be a total joint replacement. So like you do with the hip and the knee, you can get the joint surfaces in the ankle can get arthritic especially after recurrent injuries, and that joint surface can be replaced. That's an option if it truly is arthritic pain and it's limiting what you do. There are people who specialize in that and can probably give you an opinion as to whether that would be helpful or not. the ankle fusion is one of those last ditch efforts where the ankle joint is painful and it moves all the time when we walk and when we go up and down stairs, and that pain is inhibiting your life, and they don't think that it's a candidate for an ankle joint replacement or a surface replacement. And so they take bone grafts and they fuse the ankle into one piece. And then again, it's not a normal situation. So we have to modify the bottom of your shoe in order to allow you to roll forward while you walk. You don't get that push off when you're running. So you're not going to make the Packers next year if you have an ankle fusion, because you lack that power of push off and running and that kind of thing. But it should, over the long term, decrease the amount of pain that you experience in the ankle. And so in that way, it's sometimes viewed and looked at as an option.
And I was thinking about, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about daughter Emily again, who is she did long jump in grade school, you know, and she ran, of course, and all that. But when an athlete lands a jump or runs, you know, she's running the 200 and the 400, I think, in right now. How is that absorbed in the body?
Yeah, running, long jumping, all of that is a series. Running itself is a series of hops. Right. So you're hopping from one leg to the other after that. And so there's a push off phase. Your back leg is pushing off. And so your muscles are propelling you forward, your glutes and your hamstrings and your quads and your calf. And then on the other hand, you have to come back down and land on the ground. And so depending how your foot hits the ground, you're absorbing some impact at your ankle, and then your knee bends and that absorbs some of the impact, and then your hip flexes and that absorbs some of the impact. And while that's happening, the muscles are decelerating your impact with the ground. And so those muscles, when they contract to decelerate you, the tendon that attaches to them will stretch a little bit and hold on to some of that energy. And so when you go to push yourself forward on the next step, that elasticity recoils and it springs you forward and leads into the next step. So there's a beautifully sequenced series of events that happen to allow us to efficiently move through our environment that way. And so understanding all of those little aspects of that movement come into play when you're trying to figure out what went wrong in a system, what is what could be more efficient, or what resulted in an injury.
I've watched my daughter many times, and I enjoy sports at UW-Madison and watching, and I kind of pay attention. I get usually arrive early to events like that because I want to see how they warm up. And I'm wondering about stretching and warm up before and also after an event, because I know Emily's cross country coach, they do a lot after the event.
Yeah, you've been well prepared, Larry. This is a good topic to talk on here. Stretching's been a hotbed in the literature the last number of years. And again, if you go back to the start of the running craze in the 70s and everybody stretching before they run, and it's kind of common knowledge in lay population that if you want to avoid injuries, you should stretch before you run, right? And warm up. And the actual literature and the philosophy behind that has really been changing and really been evolving over the years. And so if we look at a stretching exercise, it elongates a muscle out and puts a pull on it, right? And so when you there are some conditions or some problems that we have that are related to a lack of flexibility, but not a ton of them. And so if we look at stretching as a mode of preventing injury, the literature doesn't support that a ton. And so people who are involved either stretching before or as part of their warm-up don't necessarily get injured less than anybody else. And flexibility also runs a gamut. There are people who could bend over now and touch the floor with no problems, and there are people like myself who could never get to the floor if they stretched at it for 1,000 years. And so the fact that you're more flexible or less flexible doesn't make you any more or less injury prone in long-term studies. And so the common thinking now is that stretching should be done if it's towards a goal, if it's part of your activity. So if I'm a hurdler and I have to bring my leg up over the hurdle in front of me, that way I need a certain amount of hamstring flexibility to do that activity. And so I should probably be doing some type of flexibility for my hamstrings in that point. If I'm a gymnast or a ballet dancer, I need flexibility as part of the activity that I do. And so stretching should be part of my routine. And then you brought up the question of when to stretch. If we're talking about warming up is certainly an important part of any activity and preventing and getting yourself ready to work and preventing injury. But stretching does nothing to warm you up, right? Stretching doesn't get your blood flowing. It doesn't get your heart pumping that way. And so stretching before an activity really doesn't, unless it's specific to your situation, unless somebody in my position has identified that you need more flexibility to do this exercise appropriately without getting injured, most of the time that's not a component of a good warm-up. A good warm-up should get your heart beating faster. It should get you sweating. It should get you ready to work. And stretching is not really a big part of that. Now, if we identify that you need to be more flexible, the time when you're cooling down is probably the best time, most effective time to work that into your program. And so as your muscles are all warm and stretchy and have been working and are done doing what they're doing, if we hop in the car and drive home in this short little tight sitting position, that's where we're going to stiffen up and that's where we're going to stay. But if you can take 10 minutes and do some nice, easy, gentle stretching, that will help elongate your muscles and keep your flexibility and your motion that you have in a much more effective fashion.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the first issue with stretching is when you're going to do it and who should be doing it. And the last part is how intense it should be. If you want to improve or maintain flexibility and you stretch really hard and you create a lot of little tears in the tissues, those tears are going to scar up and they're actually going to make you a little bit tighter than you were in the first place. And so if you truly want to make yourself or maintain your flexibility, stretching should be done very gently and very easily and in a real nice fashion, comfortable fashion, rather than pushing anything real hard.
Yeah, I was thinking of one time when I ran a 10K and then I jumped in the car and took off right away because I had someplace else to go. I really regretted that later.
Yeah, and you think about that, that's every youth sports practice, right? When my kids played soccer and we'd get done with soccer and everybody's hungry and everybody wants to get home and they come off the field panting and sweating and hop in the car and we had, a 20-minute ride home to get there. So by the time we get home, they're stiff and they're stuck in this little position and it has an impact on your overall flexibility and your recovery and be able to work the next time where if you can, it's hard to do, but if you can allocate that 10-minute cool down where you're going to do a little bit of stretching, a little bit of walking, a little bit of moving around, a little bit of cool down before you hop in the car, that's a much better situation.
Phoebe in Fitchburg sent us an email. They want your take, Chris, on stem cell and meniscus tears. Have you seen any before after MRI data on that? Can some meniscus tears somewhat heal themselves over time?
So that's a little newer area and probably would be a better question for orthopedic surgeons who are seeing that stuff. But in general, if you look at a knee meniscus, they're either C or O shaped. And you think about the most center part of the O, okay, the most center part is doesn't get blood supply to it. And so it's not, you could put sutures in it and you can repair it and it's not going to heal itself down very nicely because there's no blood supply to create the tissue healing that you're looking for. If the tear is in the outer parts of the meniscus and the outer ring of the O, and if you just think about Saturn having the rings around it, the outermost ring of Saturn gets a blood supply from around the knee joint capsule. And so tears in that area are generally repairable. Now, that's been known for a long time. What I don't know is whether stem cells can change any of that and whether if you have stem cells introduced to an area, if that can make a previously unrepairable tear repairable. That's a little outside my area. I haven't done surgery before and I don't plan on getting into it. So I'm going to leave that to the real experts there.
Still got a call from Arnold in Green Bay. Hi, Arnold.
Poso and Bob Annan for taking my call. I had a question regarding cortisone shots to the knee. I injured my knee hiking on some bluffs over by the Mississippi River. Got hooked on something, and then when I broke it loose, my leg went downhill. And, of course, when I landed, the knee bent the wrong way.
Yeah. So how do you, that's a decent question, Arnold. Cortisone shots in a situation like that, or maybe just in general, what are they useful? Would they be useful in his case, and are they useful in other cases, and why?
Yeah, again, this would be something to discuss with your physician specifically for your situation. There are times to do it and times you wouldn't. But the introduction of an anti-inflammatory type agent into the knee can sometimes help shut down some you know, inflammation or some pain that you're having in the knee. It doesn't fix any damage you did at that point. But if you had some previous, you know, little bits of arthritis there, you had some previous, you know, damage to the menisci, you had things going on in the knee that suddenly just aren't settling down and aren't like they, you know, behaving like they used to. Sometimes injecting the knee can help shut some of that down and help it function in a more normal fashion again. And then once it's working more normally, then maybe it goes back to how it was and whatever you have going on really wasn't an issue. And it was really just the fact that you started, you know, moving a little more funny after that injury. So I guess, you know, the bottom line on that is you know, the cortisone, sticking it in your knee is not good for your knee, but if you don't have a great knee to start with and it's being problematic, it's worth trying to see if it will shut things down and allow you to function in a way that you know, will let your knee act normally and get back to what you were doing.
Arnold, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. A listener sent an email. Tore their meniscus while biking, another one, and several therapies like electromagnetic and RICE. I'm not sure you, that's an acronym for which I'm sure you're well familiar with. What are the current interventions for knee injury other than replacement?
Well, the replacement is really something that you consider when you look at the articular cartilage. So the surface that lines the femur and the tibia, which is where the knee comes to get, where the knee is, the femur meets the tibia. There's a real slippery type of cartilage called hyaline cartilage that lines each of the ends of those bones. And so those slide over each other very nicely. When that lining breaks down and it doesn't slide very nicely anymore, then you kind of go into a spiral where it creates more friction and where it can pull on the meniscus and where the little fragments that occur in there start irritating the joint capsule. And so that's osteoarthritis. That's the process that goes on. You're talking about recovering from a meniscus tear. The question is, you know, how bad was that knee to start with? And so the meniscus tear doesn't necessarily mean you need a knee replacement. But if your meniscus tore because your knee's already kind of worn out and it got caught in a situation that it couldn't handle and it's not recovering, and they decide that the joint surfaces are such that it's probably not going to allow the meniscus to recover, or that you're going to keep having pain, then they would consider a joint replacement. But there's nothing inherent about a meniscus tear that warrants a joint replacement right off the bat.
Well, Chris, this has been really interesting, and I'm so glad that you had a chance to take a time to be with us today. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. It was a lot of fun, and I learned a lot.
Well, I truly appreciate it. You had good questions, and so did your audience. I appreciate everybody calling in. Just give a little plug for my profession. All of the questions that we've answered here today, your athletic trainer in the high school setting can help you manage that stuff. Your physical therapist in the clinical setting can help give you personalized advice and guidance on those injuries. And so, again, we talked very superficially about a lot of these injuries that these people know like the back of their hand and can bring to your individual situation.
Well, thank you, Chris. Appreciate it and look forward to another visit. Chris Geiser, a clinical associate professor and the program director of athletic training at Marquette University, our guest. He did a great job, and we'll try to get him back and do this again with him. Appreciate it very much. Coming up, we'll probably mention Tom Brady a time or two, but we'll zero in more maybe on the Packers and the Bucks and a whole lot more going on with sports. Marquette's got, for example, has got a great basketball team this year with a new coach, is really, really doing great. UW men's basketball team is doing wonderful as well. So there's plenty to talk about with our next guest as we talk sports for 45 minutes on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.